Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Sally L. Cordy, and welcome to Public Advocate Radio. My guest today is Mark Blaxall, chairman and co-founder of Health Choice. Mark also is the father of a daughter diagnosed with autism, editor at large for Age of Autism, a former director of Safe Minds, a frequent speaker at autism conferences, and he has three books, which he co-wrote or co-authored with Dan Olmsted, The Age of Autism, Mercury Medicine, and Man-Made Epidemic, Vaccine 2.0, The Careful Parent's Guide to Making Safe Vaccination Choices for Your Family, and Denial, How Refusing to Face the Facts About Our Autism Epidemic Hurts Children. And he is a graduate of Harvard Business School and Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. So, having said all that, that's quite a resume. Welcome, Mark Blaxall. Hello? Hello, Mark Blaxall? Oh, I see you're on mute. How did that happen?
Okay. Hi, Sally.
Sorry
about
that.
I was not muted on my end. No worries.
Well, you recently wrote an article that is terrific news. I mean, in the fact that it affirms what we all steadfastly have believed, but nonetheless, the study needed to have been done, and that's what you and your co-author, whose name is Amy Becker, have produced. It's called Why Are So Many Fewer Children Dying?
Well, yes, it's kind of, it's not less a study than a natural experiment, Sally. You know, we've had this lockdown, which many people have different views on, and we go into some depth on what the mortality statistics really say about differences across the country and the timing of increased mortality and the differences in age groups. But the interesting and surprising finding was that death rates among children have plummeted during the pandemic period and during the lockdowns. And that's, as you say, it's good news. It's a surprising benefit of some of the lockdowns, not anything anyone would have expected. But for some reason, we are saving children's lives. And interestingly, you know, disproportionately the lives of children of color.
Proportionately the lives of infants, I believe. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. Almost all of this difference in children, and the CDC breaks out numbers by some broad age groups, but we do have, there's another data source that allows finer groupings. And yes, almost the entire reduction in childhood deaths are the deaths of infants.
Now, does this run parallel with the frequency or lack thereof to the pediatrician's office?
It appears to be. You know, I think that's the obvious question, right? If we're saving infants' lives, what, in a natural experiment, what are the changes in behavior that might have produced that? Is it that, you know, parents are home watching their kids more carefully? Is that they're out driving less and there are fewer accidents? You know, we don't know for sure from this data source exactly what the changes that is driving the reduction in infant deaths. We do know that for elderly people, there was a real spike in deaths. The COVID problem was real. It was localized in the Northeastern corridor, predominantly some states that had almost no impact at all. So we do know that there's a lot of things going on in this natural experiment, but what we don't have is the itemization of, you know, what's on the death certificate in these cases of childhood and infant deaths. But one thing we do know is that there has been one behavior that's changed, which is that because of the lockdown, parents are less frequently bringing their infants in for their well baby checks. We've seen, you know, mainstream media reports bemoaning that fact because they're concerned that kids will fall behind in their childhood vaccines. And we know that doses administered have gone down. We know that vaccines purchased from the government Vaccines for Children program have gone down. Those are all published facts that are, you know, an outcome of the lockdown and the changes in behavior of the lockdown. And one thing we know that might be correlated, and as the saying goes, correlation does not equal causation, but it's certainly a plausible argument that the thing that is saving infants' lives is that they're not going in for their well baby checks and they're being vaccinated less frequently.
Yes, I popped a bottle of champagne when I read this. I was so enthused that the upshot was the gravest of all. Our infant mortality rate here in the United States is our disgrace. I mean,
right. The
autism rate is a disgrace, but
right. Likewise
is the infant mortality rate. And then you have a lot of graphs, and you worry, where did you source graphs?
Sally, I'm sorry, you are breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure whether that's me or you.
Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now?
It's a little broken up still.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
Well, yes, I hear you. From the lockdown.
Sally, why don't I try to call you back? For some reason, our connection is not great.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, that might be on my end. I'll call you right back.
Very good. Thank you. Shoot. Where is this? Okay. Hi there, Mark. Do you hear me?
I can hear you much better now. Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I have a question for you. Yes, I hear you fine.
Yes.
Christina England, the journalist for several publications, including the Liberty Beacon, she's writing an article about your study about this, the outcome from the COVID-19 and what has transpired. Should I call her so she can possibly engage in this conversation as well? I'm sure she has questions.
I'd be fine with that, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me reach out to her. She wanted to know if I was doing it today, and I thought that was clear, but obviously it was not. So she's waiting for this interview, I believe, to write the article.
Okay,
so
very
she
good.
May as well participate in it, right?
I'm happy to have her.
Yeah, okay. Well, she wasn't expecting me to contact her, so if she doesn't get right back, that's why. Okay. Well, I just thought we could make the best of a situation. Okay,
sure.
I'm going to hang up now, and she can call me if she wishes. Okay, so where did you get all the graphs from that you display in your – yeah.
Well, this – the major source is basically – it's the CDC. So this is all basic mortality data that get reported on a weekly basis. The main source is really the CDC's flu mortality surveillance system. And the CDC on a weekly basis tracks flu seasons, and they do this all the time, and they flu mortality is generally seasonal, and more elderly people generally die during the winter is the basic finding. But they track it, and they track differences between flu seasons, and so they collect data by flu season. They also provide the ability to download that data so you can get the mortality rates by state at the total level, and you can also break down national data by age group. and they'll report 65 and older, 18 to 64 year olds, and children under 18. So you can get that and graph it to your heart's content. And Amy, who is someone I've known for 10, 15 years, a good friend, was interested in this information. We were chatting about it online, and we had kind of an initial hypothesis, which was that if you looked at all-cause mortality, not just COVID deaths, that there would be less of a crisis than the media was promoting. Both of us are autism parents and have seen the media glom on to the hype of the infectious disease community. So we had that hypothesis, and Amy was sort of tracking it. And to our information, we did find that, particularly in some parts of the country, the coronavirus problem was very real. In New York City, it was an unprecedented and very large mortality crisis, primarily probably among the elderly. So we did, our hypothesis was disproven, although we did find a lot of differences around the country, which we go into in the paper. But then the thing
I have to tell
that
you,
was interesting,
living in New York, I just reported to the police about the deaths that are occurring in the hospitals that don't need to occur. And the interviews with the nurses, the videos with the nurses who are explaining this, and I said, and the doctors are saying it, and the funeral directors are saying it, and even Donald Trump has said there is a freezer outside of the Elmhurst Hospital, I believe he actually named that hospital. I wasn't sure where these women were reporting from, which is unfortunate because I could have more effectively reported this earlier,
Right.
But anyway, so I did finally get to report that the other day to someone who finally took me seriously and said he's going to get to the bottom of it. But this is a catastrophe. I've literally been, sending messages to Trump, help New York City. They're killing the patients. It's terrible.
There are obviously some things that are unique to New York City, and it may be the fact that it's a gateway city and more immigrants from China came in, or Europe. It may have been that density and
no,
all
those
sorts of things. But I understand
them.
There are people that are concerned about the use of ventilators and reintroducing people with infections into nursing homes. So there are clearly some issues in New York, but
somebody is authorizing and enforcing the death of people who need not die, and that's what needs to be gotten to the bottom of, and that's what I reported to the police.
Well, there are many deaths in New York City that's incontestable. Yeah.
Yes, right. Iatrogenics, I believe, is the term for it, but nonetheless, this is overwhelming, and I didn't even know where to go and protest. It was so secretive until Erin Marie's report, where you knew where she had been reporting from. Up until that point, there was no clear indication of where it was. Three hospitals for sure. I believe a fourth, another nurse just recently came out. But anyway, this is something that this is appalling. And somebody has authorized it, and somebody is defending it. And we must do something. Cannot turn children's deaths, of course, are by far the worst. The fact that, by the way, this is not just elderly people. This is 20 and above that I'm talking about here in New York City. But nonetheless, children, this has been a disgraceful situation. I've been outside the White House carrying a banner with 10 dead infants whose parents I interviewed in just 1 week. If you can imagine, as a journalist, having 10 parents come to you in 1 week saying, will you cover my story? when it is so few will talk about it for a multitude of reasons. Sorrow is at the top of that. You know, threats, another issue. So you don't get a lot of people willing to talk about it, and having 10 in 1 week, that's when I went to the White House. I couldn't get a message to them, so I went directly to deliver it to them, and they wouldn't even take it at the gatehouse. They would not accept my message. So I'm sorry.
Well, infant deaths in America, our infant mortality is higher. You know, we are, you know, a laggard in the developed world. And so this natural experiment is clearly an interesting occasion, because we have seen infant deaths go from, you know, numbers in, you know, around 400 a week to something closer to, you know, 200 and, 250. So, you know, we're saving a lot of infants' lives.
And when do they die?
By changing behavior.
2 months, 4 months, 6 months, exactly correlates with when they're being injected, right?
Well,
the infant death.
A lot of
people,
yes. Again, you know, cause Sally, I'm sympathetic. I want to try to be, you know, I want to support my own comments with data that I have confidence in and that's original. So I, you know, a lot of us are concerned that our aggressive vaccination policies are causing SIDS, and that's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, of evidence to support that. And that's what this natural experiment is showing. Yeah.
Right. I have heard, and you may know far better than I, that if you receive the Hep B vaccine at birth, you are 10 times more likely eventually to become autistic.
I've seen comparable numbers, yes. 10 seems the number I've seen that's around that order of magnitude is from the CDC's original VSD analysis by Thomas Verstraten, and there were two different numbers. A lot of it was the Hep B, you know, because it was the mercury exposure in the first year of life. One estimate put the autism risk at 7 times. Another estimate, and it's not clear what the two studies were different, but another had it at 11 times. So that's just the thimerosal content, not just Hep B. There was another study that I know of from SUNY, State University of New York folks, who had, I think, a 3 or 4 times increase in autism risk. So, yeah, I mean, the Hep B shot at birth does seem to have an autism effect from some of the data that I've seen.
Right, and that's why you are so valuable. You stick to the data, and that's what
I do my best. I'm not going to try to. I don't want to make speculations on cause and effect that I don't have direct information on. But yeah,
right.
There's, you know, we all know that the CDC has an agenda, and they are relentless in the pursuit of you know, their policy interests, and often, you know, very often those are against the health and welfare of infants, for sure.
90% of what I say that shocks people is directly from the CDC's website. How do you like that?
Yeah.
90% of what I shock, and that's because they're printing one thing, and they're saying another. You know, as you say, denial.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's see what else. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about our previous interview. You had spoken about a national survey, a national phone survey that is taken, I believe, every 4 years in regard to the rate of autism in America. And I was wondering, this would be the fourth year. This would be 2020. The last
Well, you know what's happened since we spoke, Sally, is that there are a couple of different phone surveys. And they were done episodically, not, you know, and they had been done every 4 years, but now they do it just about every year. And so I have to look, there are actually two highly related or highly similar, but but specifically distinct surveys. One is the National Health Interview Survey, and the other is, I want to say, the National Survey of Childhood Health, NSCH, and they both ask the same question, which is basically, does, you know, are any children in your household diagnosed with autism? So they've made that survey an annual survey now, which, and you can actually find the results online. So the latest data, and I'm looking this up right now, because you know, it's depending on which survey you look at, it's 1 in 36 or 1 in 33 or 1 in 40. It's in the neighborhood of 3% of children in the 2018 survey, I believe.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it has, since 2016, 1 in 36 would be now 1 in 33.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, not a surprise, and quite frankly, less than I would think. And it's for 2018. That would be 2018,
well,
though.
I'm looking it up right now. You kind of threw me a curveball, but I have to. So they do this. There's a website called childhealthdata.org where the National Survey of Children's Health is posted every year, and they sort of, it's a rolling survey. So you can search, there's, I guess, the 2017 and 2018 survey year, so they do them 2 years at a time, and the prevalence they report of, you know, children who have ever gotten a diagnosis of autism is around 3%, one in 32. 1 in 33. What's interesting is it takes all children ages 3 to 17. So it will, and it asks if any child, so it's not specific to birth year, it's just all children at a given point in time. And what that will do is, among 3-year-olds, you'll probably understate the rate, because those kids won't have yet gotten through the process of getting a diagnosis. And if they have a less severe form of autism spectrum disorder, what we used to call Asperger's, those usually don't get diagnosed until much later in childhood. The average age of an Asperger's diagnosis was 8 years old. So any survey sample with 3-year-olds in it is going to understate the rate. But if you got if you have 17-year-olds in the survey, you're gonna have a fuller rate of ascertainment. So taking that age group 3 to 17 gives you more of the older kids and more of the milder cases, because the other database, the number that gets reported often, most recently 1 in 54, is just of 8-year-olds. And so 8-year-olds will get you most of the severe cases, but will maybe miss a chunk of the milder cases of autism. So this National Survey of Children's Health it's around go ahead, sorry, 1 in 32. It surveys all children at a given point in time. So in the years 2017 and 2018, it'll ask, is anyone in the household has anyone in the household received a diagnosis of autism? And so that will include any child from ages 3 to 17. That would be in the survey. They're starting to do that survey more frequently, Sally. And that's right. That's going to be pretty accurate. But it's also going to miss some cases in the younger kids, or miss some diagnoses.
Well,
so 1 in 32 is a huge number.
Don't really get diagnosed before the age of 3. This is, I don't know anybody who's gotten a diagnosis prior to the age of 3, not to say that they haven't been autistic prior. But for some reason, that seems to be an important year, 3 in particular.
In my experience, my daughter was diagnosed when she was 2 years, 9 months, and it takes a while to get through the process of getting to a diagnostician. So there are enough cases and not enough supply of providers to do the to do the testing. So it can happen as early as age two, or maybe even earlier in some cases. But the average age of diagnosis is in the 3 to 4 year old range. So yeah, you're right. It doesn't happen until later. So a 3 year old, you're going to miss some cases or some diagnoses if you're just looking at 3 year olds.
And what do they test for? I don't know what the test comprises of.
The testing, there's a whole set of standards for what an autism diagnosis comprises. It changes over time. In fact, they just a few years ago fundamentally changed the diagnostic criteria for autism. It's very similar in terms of what it picks up, but it used to be that under the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Edition 4, there were three types of severity that were within the pervasive developmental disorders. You could have autistic disorder, PDD, not otherwise specified, or Asperger's disorder. And in the fifth edition of the DSM, they basically threw out that whole construct and introduced the idea of just a full-on spectrum, an autism spectrum disorder. They changed the naming from PDD to ASD. And then they had a range of severity and a severity score. So the whole the whole nomenclature and structure changed. But pretty much they report deficits in social skills, communication skills, restricted interests, and an age of onset that's before 3 years of age. Those are the basic criteria for an autism diagnosis. And then they have a battery of tests that they run an infant through to see whether or not they have a deficits in any of those categories. And if you have enough deficits, you get an autism diagnosis.
Now, how do the schools play into this? Because I was speaking to a special ed teacher several years back who mentioned that children are categorized not necessarily by their medical assessment, but by what is funded. So often they are misdiagnosed in the schools because the funding comes for specific diagnoses.
Well,
have you heard
that? I do know that schools have individualized education plans for children with disabilities, and there are a bunch of kind of set categories, one of which is autism, that the schools will categorize a children's services plan underneath. Whether or not how the funding works, I'm not an expert in that, Sally, and I wouldn't speak to that. I would be skeptical that, we're over-diagnosing autism because of funding sources. There's no evidence I've seen that supports that. I think children
not
with real deficits can't go to school. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true, too. I want to wish you a happy Father's Day, belated. I did a shout-out on my other radio show to all the fathers that stayed. 90%, I am to understand from Sheila Ely, of fathers don't stay in relationships when there is an autism child involved. I don't know that you are still married to the woman who bore your child. Are you?
I am divorced, Sally, but I am active in my daughter's life. But she's in fact with me for my parenting time. So she's 24 years old, and I live in Minnesota, and she's out here with me now. And her mother and I collaborate on her care, and you know, we are divorced, but we are still actively co-parenting.
Your daughter was living with you then too, so I assumed that you were still together. I apologize, but nonetheless, happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
Fathers who you couldn't be more active in this realm, Lord knows that. And you've been doing it for, I guess, 20 years?
Yes.
How long have you been
active? It's
been just about
20. My daughter was diagnosed in 1998. I became more active starting around 2000, 2001. More active in terms of the scientific issues and the controversies and all of that. So it's been 20 years or more of involvement in autism for sure.
And was your doctor forthcoming in terms of saying this was caused by a vaccine or not?
Well, my daughter's autism was definitely a regression. I try to be as scientific as I can. I don't know 100% for sure what caused my daughter's autism. We do know that she was born typical. She developed normally for a period of time, and then all of a sudden she started regressing. And I do know that she was part of that first generation of children that got the expanded CDC schedule that included the Hep B shot, the Haemophilus influenza B shot, and a lot more rigorous tracking of vaccination in general because of the liability protections that were provided under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. So she was part of that inflection point, and I certainly believe that those new exposures caused her autism. But her doctor never signed up for that. Her doctor never even mentioned it. We never filed an adverse event report. We there may have been an adverse event, but there are so many shots in such a short period of time. We didn't have a sharp, vivid vaccine reactions like I know many parents do report. But we do know that our daughter was developing normally and then regressed. And there was nothing else negative in her environment going on. We weren't farmers. We aren't near pesticides. We're in a relatively low pollution Massachusetts suburb. So, the only thing that, possibly could have explained, that regression in retrospect was her childhood vaccination schedule.
Right. And the schedule by 1998 was significantly larger than 24 doses.
She was born in 1995. So, she was, in that first round of kids that was getting, in the early 90s, that's when they began introducing the Hep B shot and the Hib shot. So she was in that, in that inflection point. The inflection in autism rates was really around 1990. So she was about, 4 or 5 years in. But she did get all of those new shots for sure.
Well, I was watching the mothers who went down to the ACIP, and one of them, a grandmother, chose to single out just stop the Hep B. There's no justification for it. Stop it.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, their justification was, when questioned, because we can, even though it was designed for other people. And that is, you can have a nightmare just about the justification for it,
I agree with that. I think, probably the single, there's competition where the badge of dishonor as to what the single worst vaccination might be, but Hep B is certainly in the running for the most ridiculous public health policy that we have. And that shot's a terribly, I mean, a dangerous, a risky shot. It's given in the first day of life. The benefits are remote, if any, and the risks are huge.
Right, and there actually was a report. You know, I interviewed a gentleman from, you know him, everybody knows him, the Refusers, Michael Belkin.
I remember
that he, oh, now I forgot, you know, this is crazy. Oh, yes. Then a friend of mine from Norway sent me an article after I interviewed him. And by the way, the second half of that interview was completely garbled. I've never had a radio show so compromised. However, the article said child dies after Hep B. That's the, you know, in hospital. But when you open the article, turns out four children died in the course of 2 days in one hospital, which would mean if it was an average size hospital, two children a day in every maternity ward. You know what I'm saying? We don't get these kind of facts. So even the title was obscured, but yet it was in the article. And I thought, oh my, how many maternity wards do we have times two a day? And that's really the outcome. A lot of mortality rates are not reported, I understand from Christina England, for up to 4 years. And I don't know if that just pertains to children, but I believe it might. And I interviewed a woman in terms of a Bill Gates campaign. She was reporting 7 years after 10,000 children had died in Pakistan, in excess of what one could expect to die in Pakistan. And I said to her, how do you know this was associated with Bill Gates? She said these deaths occurred only where his vaccination campaign had transpired. And I thought, okay, that's a good way to assess. And I'm assuming this, in fact, is how you went about drawing conclusions from your report, is an excess amount of death or less death.
Well, that's right. And what we have is just the CDC's own data. It's the, you know, mortality statistics every week in the country, broken out by age, broken out by state. And you can, and again, they're doing this to observe flu season. So it's the flu mortality tracking, and because they give you, you know, a number of years, we can just create an expected number of deaths per week based on recent years' averages. And the recent years, if you look at the charts, they tend to stay. There's variation year to year and month and week to week, but the rates tend to stay in a relatively narrow band. So you can, you know, take an average, and we took just the years 2017 to 2019. To say how many deaths would be expected in any given week, and then compare the actual deaths to that, and we did see sharp increases in deaths from all causes, and to your point, Sally, it's not necessarily coronavirus; it could be treatment of coronavirus or ineffective treatments, or it could be negligence in the hospitals because people aren't going into hospitals because the hospitals are basically only taking patients on an emergency basis. There could be all sorts of reasons why the elderly are dying at a higher rate in some of those locations. So we don't know the causes. We just know the counts, and then we get this surprising outcome among children. So that's basically all we did. It's public data. It's updated on a weekly basis, and you see higher rates in some places and lower rates in another place that was totally unexpected.
How can we affect change? Because I have to tell you, I see all the people who are coming forward now that the COVID-19 vaccine is looming and constantly being told we will not be getting our freedom anytime soon until a vaccine. And, you know, people are bona fidely concerned. I would have to say people are more aware of vaccines by at least 30% than they were previously. And people are saying, I can't believe it. We have all this these facts and nobody's paying attention. And I'm, you know, I had to laugh. This here's a man who is active in his community on social justice issues, but he is now going to completely focus on this issue because it's the most dire, and yet no one was taking this seriously. You know, so this has been our problem all along. Things that are factual and are very serious and being ignored, ridiculed, etc. Where, how can we, you know, you've been thinking about this longer than I have. I don't know what to do. I really have tried everything I can think of, 50 different actions in 1 year I took to see which one would work. One of them definitely worked better than the others, but no change has come, even though all these people are awake, aware. What do we do? How can we change this?
Well, it's a good question and a tough question. I do think one thing that has happened and has changed is that this issue is a lot more visible. There are many more of us in opposition. There are many more of us, you know, raising questions. The problem with that is there are a lot. There's a lot of power and money on the other side, and the more mobilized our movement becomes, and that movement is pretty broad and diverse. There's a whole range of flavors of people. There are people with vaccine-injured children. There are people who have lost their children. There are people who are crunchy granola younger moms who want to, you know, customize their schedule or go vaccine free. There are people that are, you know, just good citizens and are concerned about the problem. So it's a very diverse movement. It's becoming, you know, much more visible, and I think our strength as a movement is creating opposition. And so, and powerful opposition. So we're censored on Facebook, we're censored on Google, we're censored in a lot of places. You know, I sent this report on lessons from the lockdown to a bunch of media sources, most of them friendly, and I haven't yet heard back from anybody in terms of, you know, that are more mainstream than others, and I don't want to name them because I think they're, you know, they may get around to it, but you know, I wouldn't even have considered a CNN or a CBS or, you know, or a New York Times. I mean, those kinds of news sources are already compromised in terms of their, you know, positions on this. And one major contributor is that, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is the biggest advertiser on network television. So, you know, you get the news that the advertisers pay for. So our movement is getting stronger, but the opposition is getting stronger. And I think it increasingly it becomes a political problem. I think the world is now seeing the public health and infectious disease community on full display. Nobody in the country knew who Anthony Fauci was until coronavirus, but a lot of us in the autism and, you know, vaccine questioning movement know Tony Fauci and know, you know, that he's one of the leaders of you know, this infectious disease community and has been for a long time. And that community routinely lies about vaccines, about infectious disease, about the risks of the problem. And they routinely hype, you know, the risks of pandemics. So,
and yet when he published in the New England Journal of Medicine, he said the coronavirus had a 0.1 percent of a risk of death. I mean, so when he's publishing in a scientific journal, he said the truth, but when he's addressing, as I say, they have two faces, one for their crowd and one for us, and they are so divergent. My God, could they be more opposite?
Well, they do. They are a propaganda machine because their job description and their purpose in their own minds is to gain compliance with their mandated vaccine schedules or their recommended vaccine schedules. And increasingly they want to mandate them. So they have a propaganda mission, which is to hype the benefits and diminish the risks. They have a scientific mission, which is to report evidence. And those two roles compromise each other because they go on within the same organizations. And so we've seen the effect of that on science, because when they get evidence in their scientific work that contradicts their propaganda messaging goals, they mess around with the data. They will, you know, to the point of fraud. And we've seen right. that with, you know, the MMR study from CDC. We've seen that with the thimerosal study from CDC. I'm not optimistic that somehow the data on children's deaths will mysteriously change to remove the benefit that we've seen from, you know, from the lockdown. Right. They're not above, I think by and large most scientists are honest and look at evidence. But because all of this comes from a single government organization, the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, their propaganda mission is clear. The career managers, you know, in these departments, all of them have signed up to the storyline, and they're not going to do anything that jeopardizes that. So I think you have a phenomenon which is, you know, the science gets compromised in all kinds of ways. So we're not going to see the change come from science, unless new things happen or the problem gets, you know, demonstrably worse. I think it's becoming increasingly political. I think citizens are standing up. I think, what we're seeing is that it's becoming more partisan, that Republicans are more willing to defend parental rights and freedoms, you know, of individuals to make choices about their own health care. Democrats tend to be more, and this isn't true of all Democrats, but you increasingly see the ones advocating for lockdowns and for vaccine, you know, COVID vaccine mandates are on left of center more often than not. So I think you're seeing a political battle being, you know, being waged. And I don't know who's going to win, Sally. That's to your original question. What do we do? I think it's political.
Yeah.
I think we need to keep fighting for good science and for honest facts and good evidence. But, you know, but science is more political than people recognize, and particularly what gets published. So it's a tough struggle.
Well, I have to say, I'm not surprised in regard to the vaccine they were looking at, the flu shot, because the first time you get the flu shot, the first year you get it, you get two. So that directly affects the infants. They are now have two shots they are not getting, 6 months and 7 months.
There's a whole range of shots they're not getting, Sally. It's just, I think the general behavior is young parents aren't taking their kids to the doctor because of the lockdowns. And we know that. And that behavior happened in March and April of this year. And that's when we saw the declines in deaths. So it's pretty much, you know, it's a clear correlation in terms of time and outcome.
And percentage-wise?
So it would include the flu, but it's not just the flu. It's pretty much all.
Right, but a lot of
people
don't realize.
It's the 2 month visits and the 4 month visits, yeah.
That it's two shots the first year you get it. I think a lot of people would be appalled to know that. I know I was. I didn't believe it. The Sean Siegel had reported that, and I said, you better prove that to me. And there it was, right on the schedule, 6 and 7 months. But I know we did everything we could to stop this mandate for the top shots from 6 months through 5 years to attend daycare through preschool, and we prevailed eventually, and then they appealed until they restored it, you know? That was a really the only win I have ever been a part of, and
Yeah.
As I say, you don't win. I remember when it was great, by the way. I had a great time at your fundraiser for Bill Posey.
Oh, good.
Was that a love fest or what?
Bill Posey is a great advocate for children. He's a great man, too.
Well, I want to run something by you that I have sent to him now 3 times. I don't know that he's ever received it. I hope he has. But a 28th Amendment to the Constitution for health freedom, and it is not saying medical, because the woman who wrote it also in the 70s, when they were trying to remove natural remedies from the health food stores, she
right.
prevailed in preventing them from removing them. So she was at the forefront of that movement. So it wasn't just—it's not just a matter of giving a choice for medical procedures, but allowing a choice for healthful procedures. Okay, so
yeah.
It is she refers to the Benjamin Rush's comment about, you know, there will come a time when a certain class of people will be denied medical treatment and others will have it, you know, and this should be in the Constitution, and it was never put there. So she proposed I can't remember the exact wording, but it's basically a health freedom amendment. Do you think that that is something worth pursuing, especially at this time?
You know, any constitutional amendment is going to be a tough thing to accomplish. You need, you know, I think 2/3 of the states, or I forget my high school civics, but, you know, it's a heavy lift to get a constitutional amendment. And, but it's certainly a noble mission. And I generally support noble missions, even if they are not likely to succeed. Their symbolic value can often be, you know, worth a lot. But you also would, you know, maybe provoke the opposition in doing something like that. There are interesting segmentations in our world. You know, I think there are, as you said, a lot of the natural healing modalities. You know, there's a world of providers, and mainstream medicine would like to eliminate some of their competition and shut down things like that. So the right to practice health freedom has at least historically been associated more with providers than with consumers. And I think consumers, the issue that, you know, and this is why we call ourselves Health Choice, is that we consider ourselves more of a consumer movement. It's giving consumers the right to choose which procedures will be administered to their children, to themselves. And so both of those, I think those two are two very complementary movements, health freedom and health choice. In practice, they mean the same thing. Historically, they've come from different places, one from the provider world and one from the consumer world. It's basically all about the sovereignty of the individual relative to the sovereignty of the state in determining, you know, what medical care and what medical procedures and what pattern of care is administered in any, you know, in any circumstance. So I wouldn't, if I'm a betting man, I'm not sure I'd bet on that constitutional amendment passing, Sally, but I do think it sounds like a good idea.
Well, I tell you, when she passed, before she passed, she republished it. She had published it several years earlier and then republished it knowing she was about to die. And that's how I tripped into it. You know, I was just going through some of her more recent, making sure people had her current, the latest on her writings. And just before she died, she republished that. And I thought when COVID hit, I mean, I sent that to Bill Posey at the time, at thinking that this is something to evaluate. But the minute COVID hit, I thought, oh, boy, this is our moment. This is when we could actually make some moves here. And it did include, of course, the parents' right to choose for their children. It was one It only made 3 points. That was one of the 3 points. And So I don't know. I thought I'd throw it out to you because I thought, and I will send it to you.
I haven't seen it. And I would love to see it. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think we could possibly get a groundswell with the 30% at least people who are more aware than they were since COVID.
Well, there's no question that COVID will bring things to a higher level of visibility. Just as you might say, this could be our moment. I think, you know, the infectious disease people are saying this is their moment. They've always wanted mandates. They've always wanted an argument to shut down the freedom to choose. They've always wanted to expand vaccination schedules. And now I think we have to worry about things like immunity passports, our inability for adults to travel. You know, we already have an inability of children to attend school without receiving the full recommended schedule, and that those mandates are expanding in states around the country. COVID may create a new mandated vaccine. You know, some governors are saying they're not going to open up their states until they have a vaccine, or at least open them up fully. So
I've been hearing from people, this is not even a vaccine. That this is not a vaccine. This is something else. This is a gene-altering, I don't want to separate it from vaccines. There are those who are trying to, and they have a good point. This is experimental. So this hasn't been done before.
But the virus itself, coronavirus itself,
the fact that it will change your DNA and continuously.
Meaning the Moderna vaccine, the messenger RNA vaccine? I believe it's the Moderna vaccine.
That's
a whole new technology, yeah.
Right. So they're saying, they're basically calling it out as a separate thing, not a vaccine. I just got an email on that today. And I thought, well, is this a good idea? Because strategically, is it a good idea to do that? Because I would rather take it than see a child get one more shot, you know? I think to exclude this from the whole will allow – it's just our kids are in a disastrous situation right now and getting worse. And so I'm not ready to call it you could call it the kill shot. You could call it anything you want to call it, but it will affect children as well. It certainly will. But the rate at which we are going, there is no future now. Right now, we don't need one more to make it worse. We are in terms
of
the future.
What I would worry about though, Sally, is it's not. There are both. Vaccines, there's the recommended childhood vaccines, but there is the infringement on our liberty and the ability of any one of us to choose whether or not, we're going to get vaccinated. And along with that, the question of what sanction will be imposed on us if we choose to object. And, on an airplane last week for the first time in several months, and you can't go through, you can't sit in your airplane seat without wearing a mask. So that's a behavior, an infringement on our liberty, an infringement on our ability to breathe freely that, that is being imposed on us. And if we, I wore a mask. I was, as briefly as I could. But I'm sure that if I said no, I would have been denied access to the plane. If a parent says no, they'll deny your child's access to public education. So there are more and more mandates and restrictions of liberty that the public health community wants to impose on people because they believe that every vaccine they've got is perfectly safe and perfectly effective, and the only thing that is an obstacle to progress is their ability to generate more. And so, you know, the COVID-19 vaccine, whichever one it is, and the Moderna vaccine is one of a number that are in trials now. So the messenger RNA technology is brand new, you're right. I don't know that much about it, but I know that there are other technologies that are in the pipeline also. Who knows whether any of those will make it through the FDA or the clinical trial process. I hope, I'd be suspicious that any deserve to make it through, because no coronavirus vaccine has ever been invented that worked. So, why would this coronavirus be any different? There've been millions of dollars put into coronavirus vaccine development, nothing yet. And then you get all kinds of tricky questions like pathogenic priming. That if you get the vaccine, you're more likely to get really ill from the virus if you're exposed to it. So there are all kinds of problems with vaccine technology, one of which is the messenger RNA technology is unproven. But to me, the biggest concern is that public health authorities are going to take shortcuts. They're going to pay less attention to safety and health because this is more politicized, and they want to impose their preferred interventions, which include quarantine, which include shutting down businesses, which include the forced wearing of masks. There's a whole higher agenda of intrusion into the lives of regular Americans outside of children of school age that the public health folks are saying this is our moment, and that's what worries me about this moment, that we're going to overreact to the COVID experience.
It should worry you. The whole HR 6666, which is apparently in HR 6800, which has already passed the House. Are you aware of that?
I'm not tracking which bill is this, Sally. I don't know.
Let me just say, I was looking at the health component of HR 6800, which has passed the House, and that's like, I don't know, a few weeks ago or maybe a month ago by now. And then it would have to be stopped at the Senate. But it appears to have the same criteria, and it's just one portion of that bill. And that, this testing, tracing, tracking, vaccinating
contact
agenda.
Tracing, yeah.
Right. And so everyone's aware of H.R. 6666, which has not been to a vote yet. But they are not aware that is within H.R. 6800, which has already passed the House. So I made a blog on that. I'll tell people where to find it, tinyurl.com/HR6666, which was just about that bill till I found out that was in the other one, which is really, so many things fly under the radar that people are ill aware of. Certainly the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act, which allows our government to lie to us. Okay, nobody knew that was in the NDAA in 2012, and it could not have been bigger. They can use any mode of media to lie to us. And I don't know if you saw those opening statements in the Senate when they were questioning, were you there, Mark? You very well might have been there in Washington, D.C., when they had the Senate hearing on measles.
Yes, I was there, in fact.
I thought
relegated,
I was there.
Relegated to an outside observation room. They wouldn't let any of our community in to the room. It was a pretty rigged hearing. It was terrible.
Well, did you I know I went back after the hearing and listened to two opening statements from the senators, which ran about, the first one was about 20 minutes long, and the next one was also really long, and they were so nuanced, they could only have been written by the pharmaceutical industry, I would like to see, subsequent to this act, the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act, which says they can lie to us, they can propagandize, all I can say is we need the senators themselves to swear it. you know. And I know people who changed their mind about the measles shot because of what those senators said. They said, I was on the fence, but now that I've heard the Senate speak, I'm, you know, not even the people they were questioning, the senators themselves. So this is very hurtful. Everybody was concentrating on the element in the 2012 NDAA where they could disappear anybody at home or abroad. You'd never know your accuser, and you didn't even have to be 18. You know, that was a horrible thing. So everybody concentrated on that and had no idea. I found out about it from a woman in England who was warning people about it, and I looked into it. I was stupefied that they had literally flipped the meaning of the original Smith-Mundt Act, which is from the 1940s, saying you cannot propagandize Americans, to you can, and use their names again. Isn't that graceful? So that's why we can't get the truth, and we can't even point to the media and say you're lying. If they are propagating what the politicians are putting out, then they're just reporting what's being said, even though they've allowed themselves to lie to us. It's unbelievable. To me, that bill is just stupefying, you know?
Mm.
No wonder it's a big secret, right?
Yes, no kidding. Yeah.
But anyway, there were several other things I wanted to talk to you about. How did your latest book go over? Did you get good sales on that denial?
I don't think these books have been big sellers. I would have to be honest about that, Sally. I think.
Well, are they distributed to the like Barnes and Nobles or?
Denial was not. No, I think most of the sales are online and over Amazon. And I think, you know, a lot of what influences book sales is you know, publicity, and the challenge of books like that are they're going against the prevailing narrative in the media. And the thing that the public health authorities want out there, and so nobody covers it, nobody reviews it, except friendly sources. So I think it was well received among friends and not and ignored among enemies and the folks in control of.
Well,
you know,
they couldn't find it. May I just say they couldn't find it because I went to find one of Vera Scheibner's books. And unless I typed it in with the colon and the subtitle and the exact number of spaces after the colon and her full title, and I mean, I had to verbatim have everything correct, including the spaces after the colon, to get that
right,
to pop up on Amazon. So,
well, you should try searching me. Yeah, Blaxel is a kind of an unusual name. So when I search it, I generally find my books. So,
okay, well, her name is pretty, you know, pretty unusual. What I'm saying is they're hiding it. You know,
I do think
really
that
are.
The algorithms work against us for sure.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that.
The man who reported to the Senate, do you remember this with Senator Cruz? About how Google and Facebook and things of this nature are can alter the outcome of elections. One
Epstein,
election
Robert,
up to 15
Robert
million
Epstein.
Votes.
Yeah.
I don't remember
I've read
what
that
his name was. It's a psychiatrist who writes for Psychology Today.
Yeah,
that
I think
helped.
It was Epstein. Yeah. Very, very interesting
right.
work, and I believe that. I mean, the social media giants have enormous power to influence opinion, and they throttle back the messages they don't like, and they blast out the messages that they do. And
I remember
pretty concerning
getting a notification on Facebook saying go vote, and I thought, oh, that's a helpful public service announcement because I had forgotten what day it was, and indeed I got up and I went and voted. But it turns out they only put that up for Democrats.
Yeah.
So, that that was amazing. And, of course, it costs them nothing to do any of these things. And nobody knows that you're only receiving that if you're a registered Democrat, which I am, quite frankly, because I was trying to get Cynthia McKinney to run against Obama, and I wasted 2 years doing this, and she did not do it. And I thought, okay, I'll do it myself, which would have been ludicrous. But nonetheless, I just can't bear to see people go unchallenged who deserve to be challenged. And a lot of people are stepping up now, I am thrilled to say. People whose issue is health freedom are stepping up here in New York. And I'm interviewing all of them if they'll allow me to, you know, because I want to promote them for taking action, not just sitting on the sidelines and going, I hope someone does this. They themselves are doing it. So, you know, bully for them. And I hope they succeed. And I do everything I can to promote them. And, of course, they're mothers of small children who are concerned for their children.
Right. Exactly.
So, well, we have a lot to be concerned about as adults, and I welcome the adult community to this concern. Because, and if it took COVID-19 to do it, then there is the blessing. I call it a peculiar blessing, but in fact it is, because the kids have no future. So does it take to make us have no future for us to respect the fact that there will be no future without children? Okay, that's the peculiar blessing. I welcome it. It's crazy that I welcome it, but I do. Yeah. So, well, is there anything else you'd like to share with us? I wish
no,
Christina Sally,
it was great
could have
to
called
chat
in.
With you. Yeah, no, I
yeah. Is there anything in the article that you want to share that I may have cut you off and you didn't have an opportunity to share the full
spectrum
of the article?
No, it's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, the you know, it does appear contrary to what, you know, we were hypothesizing that, you know, there really has been a mortality impact of COVID, but it is localized to, you know, to some geographies and not all. It seems to be past us, and, you know, and it does seem to be concentrated in the elderly, which says, you know, we should make sure that we're protecting the vulnerable populations. And not, you know, shipping people with active infections into nursing homes, and then we are witnessing a natural experiment that's an expensive one. I mean, we're shutting down the entire economy to, you know, to fight the, you know, the virus, and but one unintended consequence and one unintended benefit is that we may be saving the lives of children, and. That's the message.
Right. That is the message, and this is why we have I can't remember how many years ago I had cause to pop a bottle of champagne in regard to this issue, maybe 10. You know, there's so few things to celebrate, and the fact that our infants are not dying is a just click my heels joyous feeling.
Yeah.
You know. So thank you so very much for putting this out there and calling people's attention to it, because it may be our greatest tool yet. It may be.
Well, I have had optimism about many breakthroughs and many great findings in the past, and inevitably end up disappointed, Sally. So I'm humble. I appreciate your words and thank you very much. I hope it's a helpful, you know, finding along the way. You know, I am skeptical about the capacity of, you know, the government departments to do anything positive, but let's hope that they do pay attention to this one and
right.
Learn the lesson.
Well, I will send it everywhere, your article in particular, and this interview has been extremely valuable to me. Learned a lot from you today, so I thank you. And that's it. Cheerio, my friend. Thank you.
All right. Sally, thanks very much.
Okay.
That's
Mark Blaxall. The most current book he has written is Denial, which you can get on Amazon. Okay, cheerio.
Bye-bye.